Chapter 8. The Invitation Only July 22nd Meeting. Oh my God! You mean all those sequences we saw in the 1980s were real? Dr. John Coffin. On June 12, 2009, Dr. Stuart LeGrease, head of the Center for Excellence in HIV/AIDS and Cancer Virology at the National Cancer Institute, and Dr. John Coffin, special advisor to the Office of the Director, also at the National Cancer Institute, sent a letter to a very select group of researchers. The letter read in part, "In 2006, XMRV, a human retrovirus closely related to murine leukemia virus, was identified and associated with enhanced susceptibility to prostate cancer." Although the public health impact of this was not immediately clear, a series of presentations at the most recent Cold Spring Harbor meeting on retroviruses provided additional support for this linkage, and also suggested that the number of individuals infected with XMRV is significant enough to be a cause for public concern. The CCR is convening a small group of intramural and extramural scientists and clinicians with interests in this area to draft a current status report and suggest next steps for NCI leadership. This meeting will take stock of how the CCR, as a leading retrovirology center, might coordinate efforts to address this potential emerging health issue. This letter from two of the leading scientists at the Center for Cancer Research Division of the NCI, nearly 4 months before the publication of their article in the October 8, 2009 issue of Science, clearly shows that many researchers besides Mikovits were extremely concerned about the public health threat posed by this retrovirus. Additional XMRV research had been presented at the Cold Spring Harbor meeting on retroviruses, but many other researchers had presented as well. A team led by Dr. Ela Singh of the University of Utah presented an abstract on the prevalence and distribution on XMRV in human prostate cancers. They noted, "We found 23% of the 233 prostate cancers to stain positive for XMRV." In conclusion, they reported, "The presence of virus in malignant cells invokes classical pathways for retroviral pathogenesis, that is, inactivation of a tumor suppressor or activation of an oncogene by retroviral integration as possible mechanisms of tumorigenesis." In plain language, the retrovirus was likely leading to cancer by either inactivating a gene which prevents cancer or activating a gene which promotes cancer. These methods of inducing cancer were well known to the retrovirologists assembled at the Cold Spring Harbor meeting. Researchers from Japan looked at XMRV infection in both healthy patients and those with prostate cancer. They wrote, "Although our study has a limited sample size, the prevalence among blood donors as determined by identifying XMRV-specific antibodies was found to be 1.7%, while that among prostate cancer patients was found to be 6.3%. The results of genomic PCR performing on the PBMCs indicate that XMRV is situated in a few fractions of blood cells and can spread through blood even though the virus replication appears to be very low. Any later assertions that the concerns over XMRV were generated solely as a result of Mikovits' research must be rejected as a false narrative." The question, which would trouble Mikovits in the years that followed, is why so many researchers, reporters, and journals were not interested in telling this very important truth. The special meeting to discuss the threat posed by XMRV was held on July 22, 2009, at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. As described in the introduction to the confidential summary of the meeting, in 2006, the human retrovirus XMRV, xenotropic murine leukemia virus-related virus, was identified and reported to be associated with certain cases of prostate cancer. Although the public health implications of this finding were not immediately clear, a series of presentations at the most recent Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory meeting on retroviruses provided additional support for this linkage and suggested that the number of individuals infected with XMRV is significant enough to be a cause for public concern. In view of these developments, it was deemed appropriate for NCI to convene a small group of intramural and extramural scientists and clinicians with expertise in this area to provide the NCI leadership with recommendations on future directions. Even before Mikovits' data had completed the peer review process, these well-connected scientists were discussing and working on XMRV. That the organizers even included Mikovits and her research in the proposed gathering was an ironic twist of the normal investigative protocol of science. The general public, less well-connected scientists, as well as long-suffering patients with ME/CFS, were blinded from results until publication, but the scientists could apparently talk about them to their heart's content. Mikovits suspected the anonymous referees hadn't refrained from the chatter either. It is well known amongst scientists that peer review is anything but confidential, and that experts discuss key papers prior to publication. From the style of the comments, Mikovits and the authors had carefully considered whether any of their three anonymous referees were in the room. She suspected at least one of them was Coffin, but later she learned this hunch was incorrect, though any number of his colleagues could have alerted him to the paper's existence. Coffin also co-organized the hastily convened workshop, a fact that stood out to Mikovits as she reviewed the roster. She'd never met Coffin before, but knew him by reputation. In addition to his position at Tufts University, Coffin held a curious title, Special Advisor to Director, for the HIV Drug Resistance Program at the NCI. In 1995, Coffin had been hired by an Interpersonal Agreement, IPA, from Tufts University, to run the HIV drug resistance program. An IPA is only supposed to last for 3 years, but Coffin stayed on for 10 years. This was against regulation, so they created a new title for him. Mikovits had a mental image of Coffin and most of his contemporaries from Frank Rossetti's stories of attending meetings with him in the late 1970s, when Coffin and many other experts had advised Rossetti not to pursue research on human retroviruses, stating human retroviruses don't exist. Rossetti recalled, "There was a prejudice, and is still a prejudice today, against a retroviral etiology in human disease, even though a couple have been found. They think those are the outliers. They think animals are different than man. The basis is that they think the human immune system is much more effective in taking care of viruses. In the last 30 years, including HIV and HTLV-1, there have been 109 new human disease-causing pathogens identified, and 65 of them are animal viruses. What does that tell you?" Mikovits hoped the decades-long passage of time and the ravages of the AIDS epidemic, which provided him with tens of millions of dollars of research funding, had since mellowed the man. 22 scientists attended the workshop, according to the summary, including many luminaries in the field. The meeting included representatives from the HIV Drug Resistance Program, Columbia University, Tufts University, the Cleveland Clinic, the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, the University of Utah, the Laboratory of Cellular Oncology, NCI, the Medical Oncology Branch, NCI, the Laboratory of Tumor Immunology and Biology, NCI, the Urologic Oncology Branch, NCI, the Division of Cancer Epidemiology and Genetics, NCI, the Laboratory of Experimental Immunology, NCI, the Laboratory of Cancer Prevention, NCI, the AIDS and Cancer Virus Program, Science Applications International Corporation, a Fortune 500 company with approximately 40,000 employees worldwide, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the Food and Drug Administration, FDA. Mikovits later recalled feeling she had made her presentation before representatives of most of the public health hierarchy of the United States government. The confidential account of the meeting listed Dr. Coffin's presentation first. It was summarized in science speak that belied the explosive nature of his words. Dr. Coffin discussed the properties of XMRV and its relationship to xenotropic murine leukemia virus, XMLV. He pointed out that different XMRV isolates are very closely related to, yet distinct from, endogenous proviruses found in the sequenced genome of an inbred mouse. These observations alleviate concerns of laboratory contamination with virus or DNA from laboratory mice, but are consistent with very recent, perhaps ongoing, transmission from a wild mouse reservoir into the human population. However, it is also possible that another animal species has been the vector for zoonotic infection. In lay terms, a couple of powerful and prescient points stand out. First, XMRV has a very close association to a known murine leukemia virus. The stretches of genetic code that were sequenced from XMRV were closely related to the previously characterized murine leukemia virus, but different enough to support its identification as a newly discovered virus that could not arise artificially from laboratory contamination, but likely had a zoonotic transmission. In other words, Coffin asserted that the virus probably leapt the species barrier from animal to human, or in this case, from mice to men, in the kind of virulent largesse that presents a substantial public health threat. Coffin stated the data was consistent with the very recent, perhaps ongoing transmission from a wild mouse reservoir into the human population. Each word underscored the possibility of a widespread, devastating outbreak. The differences between this new virus and the previously known mouse leukemia virus was enough in Coffin's view to alleviate concerns of laboratory contamination with virus or DNA from laboratory mice. When Rossetti heard Coffin say this, he leaned over to Mikovits and whispered, "It does not have to go directly from mouse to man. There could be an intermediate animal, such as a cow or a goat." At least in this initial meeting, some of the highest officials in the United States public health hierarchy had cogently concluded that contamination could not explain the XMRV results. What set of events had transpired which allowed this apparently recent cross-species jump from a mouse reservoir into the human population? It was possible that the mouse retrovirus had jumped first into another species, prior to entering into humans, the way a Lyme disease-causing spirochete jumps from field mice nymph deer ticks and ultimately to a mammalian recipient. Alternatively, the transmission could have happened in the course of laboratory investigation. In other words, from a scientist directly acquiring the virus from a laboratory animal in a quotidian moment that went unnoticed. It had not occurred to any of the scientists at the meeting that the virus could have occurred by direct laboratory transmission without any natural history in external animals. This would have been the first in the history of retrovirology. No scientist is ever held responsible for exotic biology that goes beyond anything that has ever been observed. As Mikovits said in a later Discover article, how could anyone have known? So much was unknown in this area. Only further research could prevent untold damage if the virus was indeed wreaking havoc on the human population. Another area of concern was that some species of wild mice have very large numbers of related endogenous proviruses and that recombinant viruses with long terminal repeat sequences, LTR, very similar to XMRV, are capable of insertional activation of proto-oncogenes in animal models of lymphoma, consistent with a potential for oncogenesis by this mechanism. In plain English, this meant that the part of the viruses which promote the production of viral particles when integrated in the host could promote the abnormal production of host genes leading to cancer. As Mikovits saw it, cancer was the end of the line for the damage that this retrovirus caused in people. But for the millions who suffered from ME/CFS, it was not the only damage that this retrovirus could cause. Ela Singh, a slender, soft-spoken Indian woman from the University of Utah, dropped a few more bombshells. Her findings were almost as shocking as those of Mikovits. Singh had spent several years working with Ian Lipkin and had done a postdoctoral fellowship with Dr. Stephen Goff, both at Columbia University. As recounted in the confidential summary of the meeting, Dr. Singh presented immunohistochemical and PCR data on XMRV infection. She observed XMRV expression in malignant prostate epithelial cells. Dr. Singh examined a total of 334 human prostate samples and determined that 27% of prostate cancers were XMRV positive. Her finding that 6% of the non-malignant controls were also positive has implications for the general population. Dr. Singh also found that the presence of XMRV in patients was independent of the RNAZL mutation. Other issues addressed by Dr. Singh included 1. Whether women are susceptible to infection with XMRV, 2. Whether XMRV is present in tissues other than prostate, and 3. Whether XMRV itself would be an early predictor of prostate cancer. Singh's work confirmed many of the things Mikovits had found in her own research, as well as some things that she had suspected but had been unable to prove. Singh also casually released some real surprises that should have struck everybody in the room with the power of a thunderbolt. The discovery that 27% of the prostate cancer samples Singh had examined were positive for XMRV was simply devastating. Her sample size of 334 human prostate samples was large enough to give some confidence that it was a valid finding. 1 in 6 men eventually develop prostate cancer over the course of a lifetime, and better than 1 in 4 of those men with prostate cancer showed evidence of XMRV infection. Singh's work suggested XMRV appeared to be a factor in the development of prostate cancer and in the severity of the tumor. In other words, even if XMRV proved not to be a causal factor in prostate cancer, Singh's research suggested it could accelerate the disease, creating a grimmer prognosis. Another startling finding was that 6% of the non-malignant prostate tissue controls were positive for XMRV. If 6% of the men in the United States were infected with this retrovirus, it was a staggering number. Mikovits thought again of the similarity to HTLV-1 in Asia and how it infected many individuals, but only 5% of those infected would go on to develop leukemia or the associated neurological disease HAM/TSP. The problems this retrovirus caused wouldn't show up in a pattern like HIV, striking down entire swaths of the population with visible symptomatology if left untreated, but it would be more diffuse, harder to recognize, and thus harder to attack. Given a healthy immune response and no other complicating factors, it seemed this retrovirus could live in many men for years and even decades without causing any noticeable problems. But as the men aged and the functions of their immune system started to break down, the retrovirus might begin the chain of events that led to prostate cancer. This virus could be a sleeping monster, and the question that would probably need to be asked at some point was, what caused it to wake up and go on a rampage? As Science Now reported on Silverman's work in 2012, Silverman's work on XMRV had started much earlier, around 2004. His group suspected that a virus might be involved in some cases of prostate cancer because men with mutations in the gene for RNAZL, which is involved in innate immunity, have a higher risk for the disease. If early treatment or lifestyle changes could prevent progression, wouldn't some men like to know? As Singh and Mikovits had both found, the presence of XMRV in patients was independent of the RNAZL R462Q mutation. Silverman's finding of XMRV infection only in men with the R462Q RNAZL mutation seemed to be a mistake. It would not be his only false step in the investigation. As Dr. Singh discussed later in the meeting, one could not use a microtome, a tool used to cut extremely thin slices of material called sections, to process tissues that had ever been used with mice or contamination might result. It was not until years later that Mikovits learned of the possibility that the microtome used in the original study may have been contaminated. However, the finding of defects in the RNAZL antiviral enzyme pathway was still a viable hypothesis. It's just that they didn't know why the antiviral pathway was not functioning to destroy the invading XMRV. When Singh was finishing her presentation, she noted that one of the questions that remained was whether women were susceptible to this infection. Frank Rossetti kicked Mikovits under the table. "Why don't you raise your hand and tell her?" he whispered. Mikovits leaned over to Frank. "I'm not giving away my punchline," she replied with a grin. Singh ended her talk by noting that the other two questions which remained were whether or not XMRV was present in other tissues besides prostate, and whether or not XMRV on its own could be used as an early predictor of prostate cancer. After Singh's talk, Mikovits felt the excitement in the room increase dramatically. Scientists were talking spiritedly with each other, praising Singh, and it was difficult not to feel that science was on the verge of an important discovery. Then Dr. A. Dusty Miller, a scientist from the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, Washington, threw a bait and switch to a still wrapped, but momentarily quieted audience. Dusty, as he preferred to be called by his colleagues, was a slender man with an easygoing smile, but strong determination when he believed in something. He presented two critical XMRV findings. The first substantiated a theory that the XMRV retrovirus could infect all types of cells, and the second, more controversially in the eyes of Mikovits, supported the idea that XMRV might not be something to worry about at all. These ideas seemed almost diametrically opposed enough to cancel each other out. The confidential summary of the meeting detailed his findings this way. Dr. Miller discussed host range and receptor use of an XMRV strain isolated from 22 RVI cell line, which was established many years ago. 22 RVI cells were derived from a patient with Gleason grade 9 prostate cancer in 1991, following multiple passages through nude mice, suggesting that XMRV has been present in humans since at least 1991. Preliminary data from the Miller lab suggest that XMRV has transforming potential in cell culture. However, unlike the oncogenic mink cell focus-forming retroviruses, his data suggests that XMRV cannot multiply reinfect cells in culture, causing cytopathicity, cell death. One of the most critical findings was the discovery of an XMRV strain derived from prostate cancer tissue, which had undergone multiple passages through nude mice, a common type of laboratory animal. This statement of the natural history of XMRV could certainly account for ME/CFS being seen in the 1980s. But then Miller would later illogically claim that since the modern ME/CFS was written into the medical literature before 1991, the retrovirus could have nothing to do with the disease. This was as odd as an archaeologist stating that his carbon data from a single site marked the genesis of an entire civilization without digging any further. The genesis of a disease could not be pinpointed from such a small amount of data. Miller also later claimed that the findings of XMRV by Mikovits and others was the result of contamination by the 22 RVI cell line, disputing Coffin's earlier implication that contamination was not possible. Mikovits would later show that the 22 RVI cell line had never been in her lab, and that there was no evidence that the cell line had ever been in the whole state of Nevada. But Miller would increasingly dig in his heels over time and claim that, for a number of reasons, the 1991 genesis of XMRV was the only reasonable possibility. Miller felt the discovery of an XMRV strain in the 22 RVI cell line was a unique event, something that could not have happened prior to that date, and he was insistent on his theory. Retrovirologists later came down on his proposed immaculate recombination, defined as an event that could happen at only one place, at one time, in all of evolutionary history, but it was surely a bold statement on XMRV's origins. His evidence led Mikovits to another, perhaps more alarming, conclusion. If XMRV had inadvertently been created once in a lab, it could happen again and could have happened before. The process might be immaculate in the sense that it arose in a seemingly sterile environment, but that did not mean the recombination had a one-time, one-place origin. Recombination could instead be an event caused by synergistic factors that were common in unrelated labs at different times. Thus, maybe this recombination, or one closely related to it, had taken place a number of times in the past, whenever mouse and human biological materials had shared the same test tube, petri dish, or even when they had simply shared the same lab. In July 2011, scientists published evidence that XMRV could spread through a laboratory by aerosolizing it, an even more alarming event. Doctors Yuan Zhong, Anirban Maitra, and Adi Gazdar, et al. Of the University of Texas Southwestern, published a paper in the journal Cancer Biology and Therapy, in which they investigated the presence of XMRV-related retroviruses in human cell lines, which had been established from mouse xenografts. Xenografts are the transplantation of tissue from one species into another for purposes of research. Human cancer cells are often xenografted into mice because the cancer cells grow so abundantly in the mouse tissue. Gazdar was well known for his investigations into simian virus number 40, SV40, a monkey virus which had contaminated both the Salk and Sabin polio vaccine and had produced evidence of carcinogenity. Prior to working at the University of Texas, Gazdar headed the tumor cell biology section of the NCI. The medical establishment had, in fact, ultimately concluded that the Salk and Sabin polio vaccines were contaminated with SV number 40, a result of the growing of the virus in monkey kidney cells. But they also concluded, erroneously according to Gazdar, the virus did not pose a threat to human health. Gazdar simply did not share in that view of SV number 40's harmlessness. An excellent account of the entire SV number 40 controversy can be found in the book The Virus and the Vaccine by Debbie Bookchin and Jim Schumacher. He and his team examined tissues from xenograft tumor cell lines from 7 independent laboratories and 128 non-xenografted tumor cell lines. The cell lines were tested for mouse DNA and came up negative. What they found would confirm the fear that the passage of human tissue through mouse biological materials presented the danger of creating a recombinant retrovirus, but would also raise the specter of a completely unexpected threat. Gazdar and Zhang reported 6 of 23, 26%, mouse DNA-free xenograft cultures were strongly positive for MLV, murine leukemia virus, the same family as XMRV, and their sequences had greater than 99% homology to known MLV strains. 4 of 5 supernatant fluids from these viral-positive cultures were strongly positive for RT, reverse transcriptase activity. 3 of these supernatant fluids were studied to confirm the infectivity of the released virions for other human culture cells. This meant that a little more than a quarter of the xenograft cultures showed evidence that they had picked up a murine leukemia virus during its passage through the mice. This was confirmed by both reverse transcriptase activity, the enzyme an RNA or retrovirus releases in order to transform its RNA into DNA so it can take over the machinery of a cell, as well as the ability to infect other human cells. This was truly a Frankenstein scenario. The ability to infect other human cells was an important demonstration of the danger of these viruses to the human population. A certain portion of health advocates claim that natural and internally occurring or endogenous human retroviruses, if stimulated by chemicals in the environment, could be the true cause of many contemporary illnesses. This argument certainly raises an important discussion, that is, do ubiquitous chemicals in daily life switch on internal passenger retroviruses to make them suddenly steer the body toward disease? But if a pathogen shows the ability to infect other human cells, it demonstrates that the virus has not become endogenized, because it is now acting out instead of merely acting in on its host. A virus that has become endogenous will instead integrate itself into the human genome, and then it normally loses the ability to infect, so its damage is not endlessly disseminating. Some virologists view loss of the ability to infect other cells as the price the virus pays for living in symbiosis with its host. It assimilates into the structure and function of the body, becoming a visceral occupant rather than an enemy faction. Some researchers claim that these endogenous viral genes may make up as much as 12% of the human genetic code, so they are common. But if this virus had not become endogenized, it meant it had probably made the jump to humans within recent history. For those who understood the potential dangers of viruses and the promiscuous manner in which they could evolve and recombine with other pathogens to create even more virulent strains, the next finding by Gazdar and Zhang was the stuff of apocalyptic nightmares. Of the 78 non-xenograft-derived cell lines maintained in the xenograft culture-containing facilities, 13, 17%, were positive for MLV, including XMRV, a virus strain first identified in human tissues. These were not cell lines that had been passaged through mouse tissue. These were cell lines that had simply been in the same laboratory as cell lines which had been passaged through mouse tissues. Among the plausible explanations for this alarming occurrence, these viruses could become airborne. In other words, the virus created in the lab could escape by simply floating away. Those who lived through the terror of the early days of the AIDS epidemic well remembered the fears of many people who watched dramatic symptoms leading to wasting and death ravage whole communities. Many assumed the HIV retrovirus could be spread by casual contact, such as a kiss, the holding of hands, a hug, or even a sneeze. Political and cultural hysteria soon followed, as people divided themselves into opposing groups with a panicky scramble for safety, often blaming and condemning those who were ill. But the fears had been unwarranted. AIDS had fallen prey to a long tradition of mystifying modes of transmission before pathogen theory showed that cultural hand-washing of human responsibility should not supplant actual sterile practice. Rubbery latex gloves and condoms ironically made flexible thinking possible again. However, now scientists worried that XMRV might be the realization of that nightmare scenario that many feared with AIDS, where just sharing a closed airspace with an infected person could put one in serious danger. This horrifying image so worried the Department of Health and Human Services that its Director of Health of Blood Supply made an urgent phone call to Frank Rossetti and said, "Our number one priority is to determine if XMRV is a health risk." The last finding of the Gasdar and Zhang paper provided strong evidence that XMRV might have the capability to become airborne, rather than contaminate cell cultures in some other manner. They wrote, "By contrast, all 50 cultures maintained in a xenograft culture-free facility were negative for viral sequence. If the cultures were kept in facilities without mouse xenograft cell cultures, the risk of contamination appeared to be essentially zero." In their concluding remarks, the Gasdar and Zhang team wrote, "XMRV, originally identified in human tissues, is a retrovirus closely related or derived from XMLV, xenotropic mouse leukemia virus, and believed to derive from the recombination of pre-XMRV1 and pre-XMRV2 proviruses in mice." These findings clearly demonstrated that xenograft cell lines, currently widely used as experimental models, can potentially acquire XMLV, including XMRV, after mouse xenografting. And how did XMRV infect these cultures? Was the virus simply wafting out of its mouse xenograft cultures to infect other cell lines? Or were the lab workers themselves being infected with the retrovirus and then spreading it? No one could say. When Mikovits read the Gasdar and Zhang paper in July of 2011, she couldn't help but remember the fears she'd had as a young technician in the fermentation lab about the potential for infectious spread amongst her fellow lab workers as they performed the job of purifying HTLV-1, the first identified human retrovirus from the seminal study of Poise and Rossetti, from hundreds of liters of tissue culture. It was what made the unsuspenseful meticulousness of a lab palpably risky, especially when lab workers handled an unknown pathogen. The data Miller presented at the July 22, 2009 meeting had some bearing on the question of how infectious this retrovirus was likely to be. The confidential summary recounted that the wide XMRV host range was demonstrated by its ability to infect human fibrosarcoma cells, rat fibroblasts, canine kidney epithelial cells, and mink lung epithelial cells. In other words, XMRV favored many species, making it difficult to rein in. XMRV had in fact demonstrated the ability to become airborne and infect tissues in 4 different species, especially epithelial cells, which are usually located on the inside lining of blood vessels, where the virus could be released into the blood. XMRV was shaping up to be a very dangerous virus. Mikovits was slated as the last speaker before the roundtable discussion. The confidential summary's account of her talk eclipsed the others in length as the most scientifically sound presentation, giving an unspoken clue to its centrist role in the hastily convened meeting. It warranted the longest summary to the officials who had realized it contained complete data on XMRV in humans. Dr. Mikovits presented data from a Nevada cohort linking XMRV infection with chronic fatigue syndrome, CFS, and potentially lymphoma in 300 CFS cases identified from 1984 to 1987. RNA, DNA, plasma, and frozen PBMC were collected from about 100 of these patients between September 2006 and July 2007. Of these, 68 CFS patients were positive for XMRV. Equally important was that 3.75% of local controls were XMRV positive. As with Dr. Singh's work, these results have implications for the general public. If these numbers are reproduced in a larger survey, they would suggest that as many as 10 million Americans are infected with XMRV. Similar results were generated from a Florida-Carolina cohort of CFS patients, such as 60% positive for XMRV GAG from fresh PBMC. XMRV was also detected in saliva samples, and plasma transmission was demonstrated from greater than 80% of CFS patients' plasma. In these studies, there was no correlation with XMRV infection and R-nasal mutations. Finally, Dr. Mikovits, with NCI co-authors Francis and Sandra Rossetti and Cleveland Clinic co-author Robert Silverman, indicated that a manuscript showing XMRV enrichment in individuals with CFS was under review. However, experiments investigating a link to lymphoma were still under investigation and were provided in preliminary form to alert NCI leadership, given the potential public health implications. The confidential summary gave a good account of her presentation. Mikovits expected the research to generate controversy and understood there might be a pitched battle that would last for years, as it had with HIV and AIDS, but this... The research was supposed to neatly transit to science, receive anonymous reviews from referees whose job was to parse out scientific concerns, and then, if she carefully and methodically assuaged their objections, the article would be published. After that point, the research would enter the scientific marketplace of ideas in which others would either confirm or disprove the findings. This was something else entirely. This was a glass-walled confessional where not just the scientific content, but her very ideas were seen as something to scrutinize, or perhaps tame, before dispersal to the general public. The scene felt like one of those science fiction movies where harried government authorities in a hollowed mountain bunker try to come up with a plan of counterattack for some expected alien invasion before alerting the public to the threat. Mikovits couldn't decide whether the government effort made her feel better or worse. Were they more worried about the danger of XMRV, or the potential public stampede, or others in science stampeding onward, if the danger became known? She felt ethically mandated to defend her research, and if possible, shorten the time the patients afflicted with ME/CFS and other diseases had to wait for effective treatments. Too many patients slogged through stalled lives already. In the brief time between the July 13th resubmission to Science and the July 22nd meeting, Mikovits worked extensively on the slides for her presentation. She began by defining ME/CFS using the CDC's own criteria, Fukuda 1994, which included persistent or relapsing fatigue of 6 months or longer in duration, other known medical conditions excluded by clinical diagnosis, and at least 4 symptoms from a list of 8, including impaired memory or concentration, sore throat, tender cervical or axillary lymph nodes, muscle pain, multi-joint pain, new headaches, unrefreshing sleep, and post-exertional malaise lasting more than 24 hours. Mikovits defined the cohort as being from a cluster of 300 cases of ME/CFS, which had been identified from Incline Village, Nevada from 1984 to 1987. The summer-long effort of her young team to collect RNA, DNA, plasma, and frozen peripheral blood mononuclear cells from about 100 individuals in both September of 2006 and July of 2007 was completed. RNA, DNA, and plasma had been collected from 320 normal regional controls between 2004 to 2008 by her colleagues at UNR. Mikovits was especially proud of one of their most telling innovations, the inflammatory cytokine chemokine signature. Using this information, Mikovits was able to augment her presentation and suggest that CFS was a multi-system disorder manifested by inflammatory sequelae, including antiviral enzyme RNase L dysfunction, low natural killer NK cell numbers and function, and innate immune activation. On an overhead projector, she then displayed her PCR gels of XMRV gag and envelope proteins. She flipped to another compelling slide of the phylogenetic analysis of XMRV that placed the retrovirus in its evolutionary family. Then she clicked to another PCR gel that demonstrated XMRV protein expression in activated peripheral blood mononuclear cells, compared with an absence of such expression in normal donors. Summarizing the data, she was also able to show XMRV protein expression in B and T cell lymphocytes, which had been activated and purified. The next few slides showed the protein gels, known as Westerns. She demonstrated how XMRV had been transferred from both activated peripheral blood mononuclear cells and patient plasma to LNCAP cells. In order to study a virus, one has to be able to grow the virus in very large quantities in the laboratory. To provide an even more dramatic visual, she included two electron micrograph pictures showing the retrovirus budding from a ME/CFS patient's white blood cell. All that was known from previous studies was the demonstrated presence of the XMRV retroviral sequences and Singh's new data showing XMRV protein in prostate cancer biopsies. The next group of slides evidenced antibodies to the envelope of the XMRV retrovirus in several of the CFS patients and showed how the suspected RNase L variant R462Q, Silverman's claim, did not correlate with XMRV infection. In other words, despite an overlapping finding of RNase L defects between prostate cancer and ME/CFS, Silverman's claim that XMRV was directly linked to a specific genetic mutation did not prove true in their research on ME/CFS. She then displayed her next slides, preliminary results from a ME/CFS cohort of trainees in Florida and Carolina. Interestingly, the Florida and Carolina cohort showed differing results for XMRV infection based upon which assay was used. When looking for just XMRV gag proteins in fresh peripheral blood mononuclear cells, 9 of 15 samples were positive for an infection rate of 60%. But when combining Western blot for XMRV envelope and gag proteins upon co-culture of plasma or peripheral blood mononuclear cells with LNCAP, 13 of the 15 samples were positive for an infection rate of 86.7%. If one simply looked at whether the plasma samples contained antibody to the XMRV envelope, the rate was 8 out of 15 for an infection rate of 53%. The important takeaway seemed to be that, depending on the assay used, the infection rate among the same 15 samples could vary from a low of 53% to a high of 86.7%. None of these were minuscule or chance-driven percentages, but to assure the highest accuracy, careful processing and using multiple tests was key. Toward the end of the presentation, Mikovits showed a slide listing 20 Nevada CFS patients with cancer or suspicious biopsy findings. As she spoke, the somberness of these slides seemed to sink in. This audience understood the language of cancer more concretely than the vague misnomer of chronic fatigue syndrome. Mikovits noted how quiet and attentive the entire group was as they riveted their gaze on the slides and took in all the cases of mantle cell lymphoma, thymoma, and myelodysplasia. These words seemed to humanize the presentation for them. Of her many former colleagues from the NCI, all understood the gravity and lack of knowledge of pathophysiology of cancer, despite more than 40 years of study. Mikovits could almost see in their eyes a shift in their thinking as they considered reawakening an idea which had long ago been proposed, but for which over the years there had been precious little evidence. Could many cases of cancer be the consequence of a decades-long retroviral infection? The implications of this would be mind-boggling, shifting at least some cancer research into the field of infectious disease. In the final slides, Mikovits put forth her conclusions and the formidable challenges that lay ahead. First, she conveyed that infectious XMRV had been found in lymphocytes and plasma from slightly less than 75% of ME/CFS patients. She noted that XMRV in ME/CFS and prostate cancer were closely related and formed a distinct phylogenetic, evolutionary, and genetic branch. She also reiterated that her team discovered an immune response had been detected in some ME/CFS patients, and their evidence indicated the retrovirus caused a neuroimmune deficiency predisposing the patients to cancer. Alarmingly, she also put forth that the rate of positive infection in the general population suggested that the public was at significant risk from XMRV, and that millions in the United States alone could be impacted. While it was unclear how many detours this pathogen could take as it spawned illness, it seemed that it could be a factor in both extremely debilitating and deadly disease. She underscored the challenges ahead: development of an accurate diagnostic test, therapy for those already infected, and perhaps a vaccine to protect the public, if one could be developed. When she finished talking, she scanned the room and saw barely a fidget or the flick of a pen cap. The energy was taut as the scientists absorbed the implications of what Mikovits had just said. They all seemed dumbfounded, the slides now after images of a horrific, uncontained crisis. A large-scale scientific calamity had been brought to light, and most of them looked wary of blinking. Finally, a scientist broke the dead air, standing up to ask a question that prompted a barrage of questions directed at Mikovits, as well as animated whispering among the other scientists. Frank Rossetti later told Mikovits that at that moment, Coffin leaned over to Dr. Vineet Kuel Ramani, also of the HIV drug resistance program, and said, "Oh my God, you mean all those sequences we saw in the 1980s were real?" When Rossetti told Mikovits about overhearing Coffin's remark, she knew immediately what it meant. It was as if she and Coffin had stumbled into the same walled city of the walking wounded and were now privy to a macro-lensed view of suffering as well as its microscopic guts and gore. They now saw the same epidemic clearly. In the months and years to come, Coffin would be on both sides of that wall, first championing the work, and then when it appeared that XMRV had no natural history of human infection, seemingly doing everything in his power to bury Mikovits, though the mistake had been made years before in the original prostate cancer research. Curiously, nothing was done to the investigators studying XMRV in prostate cancer. All of this had, remarkably, happened before lunchtime. The gathering broke for a midday meal, and Mikovits was so wired from nerves and excitement, she wondered whether she would even be able to get her wobbly legs out of the room. Adrenaline pulsed through her, but after she strode from the auditorium, she found it easy enough to scarf down a few calories, because she knew the afternoon session would be mercilessly drawn out with so much ground to cover. Some folks were abuzz with excitement at this point, and others looked simply tired, but as she made her way back to the workshop, she felt ready to lean in and assert her presence in what felt like a seminal moment. The ensuing roundtable discussion covered a panoply of concerns, as detailed at length in the confidential summary. They were broken down into four areas: epidemiology, basic research, procedural issues, and action items. Regarding epidemiology, the group agreed, the most critical research goal is to rapidly assess the prevalence, distribution, mode of transmission, and diseases associated with XMRV infection in the human population. The group noted, Abbott Laboratories has been licensed to develop diagnostic assays and has developed a first-generation antibody-based diagnostic. The prevailing opinion was that the Abbott antibody test is not yet suitable for these purposes. However, they noted the NCI was designated as a repository for coordination of samples for distribution to research groups in order to determine the most appropriate assays. The group tasked the Division of Cancer Epidemiology and Genetics at the NCI to play a lead role in these initial efforts. The confidential summary further urged that studies should address the mode of transmission, human to human, mouse to human, as well as the mechanism. Some members had raised concern that sexual transmission among humans was a reasonable possibility, adding to the importance of further research. Could XMRV be spread like HIV? Were unknowing victims having unsafe sex? Another major concern was that the scientific record showed mouse leukemia viruses already caused a number of immunological and neurological diseases in animals, creating an urgent need to determine whether such a pattern was also evident in human beings, as Mikovits's presentation suggested. MLVs related to XMRV infect many tissues and organs and cause a wide variety of malignant and non-malignant, such as immunological and neurological, diseases in mice. Broad surveys to look for such associations with XMRV infection in the human population are critical to understand its full impact. As noted in the last part of the epidemiology section, participants also voiced concern about the blood supply, animal handlers, and lab workers. Serious issues regarding protection of the blood supply, as well as transmission of XMRV or related viruses to risk groups such as animal handlers and laboratory workers who handle cell lines that were derived from mice, need to be addressed. This, of course, could put more unknowing people at risk, from wounded hemophiliacs to veterinarians. Once epidemiological issues had been cleared from the agenda, the workshop participants moved swiftly to the research issues. First, they addressed in the basic research discussion the finding that the Arnazel R462Q genetic variant did not appear to be associated with XMRV infection. In view of presentations from several individuals, Silverman, Klein, Singh, Mikovits, the role of Arnazel in XMRV infection remains ambiguous and needs to be clarified. The question over the genetic variant, which about 10% of the population carries, was important whether genetics made some individuals into resistant carriers of the pathogen, who might simply shuttle it along yet never grow ill, or whether some people could be more likely to contract XMRV. Next, they discussed whether XMRV was a causal agent or passenger in prostate cancer. The group expressed the opinion that the clearest evidence will come from analysis of clonality of integration sites in tumors, particularly if they are well placed to affect expression of known proto-oncogenes. Put simply, the participants asked whether or not the retrovirus could integrate itself into places in the DNA that were known to be involved in the development of cancer. If the virus did integrate into such sites, the researchers would have strong evidence that the infection was in fact causing cancer. The summary prodded the medical community to develop reliable and inexpensive animal models mimicking XMRV infection and pathogenesis. Even within the dry language, exciting momentum and collaboration seemed to shimmer on the horizon. The summary's tone conveyed both an appropriate urgency and a respectful gravity. The text advised it was of particular importance to develop these expanded animal models and determine the mode of transmission, especially in light of the report from Mikovits that XMRV can be detected in saliva. It also noted that additional studies are necessary to determine the role of XMRV infection in neurodegenerative disease associated with many CFS patients, suggesting a longitudinal commitment to these patients that had not been previously seen. The group also seemed to take the ME-CFS cancer link seriously, noting that the suggestion of enhanced lymphoma incidence associated with CFS should be vigorously investigated, particularly the possibility of direct involvement of the virus in these malignancies. Jumping to the question of what treatments might be currently available using drugs already approved, the summary boldly asserted that initiating a clinical trial of CFS patients treated with available antiretrovirals, such as AZT, was proposed. In other words, the group recognized that CFS was life-robbing enough to warrant an immediate trial of drugs typically used for AIDS. However, Coffin compellingly argued that the high degree of sequence similarity between different XMRV isolates suggested low-level replication, which poses a problem for retrovirals, since existing drugs tend to be the most effective on a fast-moving virus like HIV. Another issue was that even though XMRV is closely related to proviruses found in inbred lines, it is not identical to any of them, and even very small sequence differences are known to have large effects on species and tissue tropism and pathogenicity. At the moment, there is no reason to believe that XMLVs are human pathogens. However, research to investigate this issue is urgently needed. The document illuminated one point. A great deal of basic research needed to be done to answer some very important questions about XMRV. Regarding procedure, the roundtable meeting tackled some riveting concerns around biosafety, implying the seriousness of the risk to lab workers, and an escape of the virus beyond lab walls. One participant asked, considering the oncogenic, cancer-causing potential of XMRV, what are the appropriate biosafety guidelines? Guidance from work with HIV should prove useful, given the basic similarity among retroviruses. Traditionally, oncogenic retroviruses are handled in the research laboratory under BL2, Biosafety 2, conditions. Dr. Hughes should take a lead role in discussing such issues at NCI Frederick. Second, participants addressed the significance of cell lines that had already been passaged through mouse tissue. How does one deal with human cell lines that have been passaged through mice and have a high likelihood of carrying infectious XMLV? This is a major concern for researchers using these cell lines, for issues of biosafety as well as experimental contamination. Similar concerns were raised about anyone who worked with the mice. Of course, the potential runaway train of public hysteria and panic were also addressed. With these concerns in mind, how does one present the potential health hazard associated with XMRV infection to the general public? Given the publication of many of the results presented at this meeting is imminent, this issue is particularly urgent. Because so many of the research findings were on the verge of being published, the participants generally concurred, the NCI should have a procedural plan in place as an immediate follow-up to planned press releases from the participating institutions involved in the association of XMRV infection with CFS. Other NIH institutes, NIAID, NHLBI, and federal agencies, FDA, CDC, RAC, should be notified of the NCI response prior to release of this statement. If one reviews the summary from a retrospective distance, the participating agencies seem to be as calibrated as a Swiss watch, showing both appropriate public concern and the want of a timely response. Given the relative lack of discord, it is almost impossible to imagine this same group scattering or participating in infighting. There is little ominous futurity in this well-calibrated watch group, where the response seems both optimistic and appropriate. At this very early point of investigation into XMRV, there was evidence of it being involved in a quarter of prostate cancers, an overwhelming majority of ME/CFS cases, a connection to various types of lymphomas, and an infection rate among the general public, which varied in studies from 3.75% in the Mikovits cohort to 6% in the Singh group. So most of the participants seemed aware that they were dealing with a significant potential threat to public health. They were, in fact, revving up to go ahead with an action plan. The action plan broke down into five parts. First, Legris, the co-chair of the meeting with Coffin, would summarize the meeting and circulate the report to the participants for their comments and corrections. Second, a special team would meet 2 days later, on July 24, 2009, to discuss pressing action items. The consensus was that the most immediate actions should be the evaluation and improvement of currently available diagnostic reagents, which would enable epidemiological studies to better understand the extent of XMRV infection in cancer patients and the general public. The third action item concerned identifying the best way to develop a reliable diagnostic test. Also, the general opinion was that a diagnostic test developed by Abbott is not yet sufficiently reliable, although details were not available. Thus, it was suggested that NCI should play a leading role in providing a panel of positive and negative samples for extramural researchers to test individual assays. Abbott Laboratories did not have a reliable diagnostic test, and it seemed the participants were skeptical of Abbott's ability to develop one. The fourth action item belied a curious paternalism regarding how the roundtable group wanted to release information on XMRV to the general public. In full, this part of the confidential summary reads, "A sensitive issue is the need for NCI senior leadership to issue a statement in parallel with a planned release linking XMRV with CFS, which is planned for simultaneous release by three institutions. The response to a report that an MLV-based retrovirus is potentially oncogenic and infects humans could range from a responsible scientific reaction to the hysteria that accompanies internet reports, and the NCI should be positioned to make an appropriate statement. Dr. Coffin will prepare a draft letter for distribution and discussion among meeting participants and ultimate submission to the NCI director. Dr. Coffin has also proposed that John Cohen of Science be brought in to provide the appropriate perspective for the public. Sharing this information with other NIH, NIAID, NHLB, and federal, CDC, FDA, RAC, institutions, and at the appropriate time is important. Is it possible that the responsible reaction to evidence that a retrovirus is involved in more than a quarter of cases of the most common type of cancer among men, in a debilitating disease like ME/CFS, which is estimated to affect 1 million people in the United States and 17 million people across the world, as well as in many cases of lymphoma, would be a little bit of hysteria? Would the public's interest in having a clear and unobstructed answer to these questions be such a bad thing? Weren't the scientists involved in public health? As the roundtable group deliberated about how to best manage this information, they needed to appoint their designated writer. The man, who later evolved into Mikovits's nemesis, had an answer. Dr. Coffin has also proposed that John Cohen of Science be brought in to provide the appropriate perspective for the public. While some might see nothing wrong with this arrangement and might eagerly anticipate having the appropriate perspective offered by John Cohen of Science, others might view this as something more akin to a well-oiled corporate communications strategy, rather than the rough and tumble of a free press. After all, scientific journals were not supposed to play dual roles of reviewing scientific papers and doing public relations for a national health crisis. This could surely be considered a conflict of interest. If scientific curiosity was legitimately based on objectivity, shouldn't data be presented without the filter of a public relations strategy? What a person thinks about such affairs will likely be determined by their belief about whether any group of individuals working in isolation away from the eyes of the public can be trusted to decide which information should be presented to or withheld from the citizenry. It is well known among scientists that the most important part of a publication is not the data you show, but the data you do not show. Unfortunately, Mikovits had been trained by Rossetti to show all of the data. One thing was clear. The group that met at the National Cancer Institute on July 22, 2009, to discuss XMRV, determined that this information had to be carefully managed. And John Cohen of Science was Coffin's ideal man for the job. In the fifth action item, the roundtable group talked about the possible threat to researchers who worked in labs containing cell lines that had been passaged through mouse tissue. To Mikovits, the workshop, although unexpected and unusual in many respects, had been a complete success. As soon as she was able to pry herself away from the other participants, she eagerly called Harvey and Annette Whittemore, who were in Reno awaiting word from the conference. She knew the Whittemores would understand a sports analogy, so she exclaimed, "World Series, Game 7, Ninth Inning, Grand Slam, Walk Off." After giving them that positive report of success, she delivered the highlights of the rest of the meeting. Mikovits knew from experience that the NCI would start to go into scale-up mode to study all the questions raised about XMRV. She had first joined the NCI as a young lab technician shortly after HTLV-1 had been discovered. Now she couldn't help but feel she'd been present at the birth of something similar to HIV with XMRV. Judy Mikovits and Frank and Sandy Rossetti celebrated that night at a restaurant in Frederick, Maryland that Mikovits had frequented when she lived in the area. Frank drove her to the Washington Dulles Airport the next morning and dropped her off. She was in an airport lounge when her cell rang. The woman quickly identified herself as an editor from Science. "I just sent you an email," she said hurriedly. "Did you get it?" The urgency in the woman's voice was not something one expected from the editor of the world's most prestigious journal of original research. The editor asked that Mikovits send all of the data from the manuscript because they needed to start working on editing the article. Mikovits explained she was in an airport lounge and didn't have the figures on her iPhone. Okay, then just send me the text, the Word document. We'll get working on that. Mikovits told her she would do that immediately. After sending the Word document to Science, Mikovits took another sip of wine and allowed herself a wry smile. Did she really believe that the phone call from the editor at Science had come because the three referees had finally made it through the paper and deemed it worthy of publication in just 10 days? Not a chance in hell. In all likelihood, the lead of those three anonymous referees were among the 22 leading scientists gathered for the XMRV workshop at the NCI, walking incognito among the attendees while they ate their lunch. It was also no stretch of the imagination to say her work had been vetted by researchers from the leading research institutions, including Columbia University, the Cleveland Clinic, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, and the University of Utah, multiple branches of the NCI, the CDC, the FDA, and industry in the form of the Science Applications International Corporation. So who did she have to thank for the expediting call from Science? It could have been John Coffin, who just happened to mention that John Cohen from Science should be the one to provide the appropriate perspective for the public. She phoned Harvey and Annette Whittemore again, told them of the conversation, and said, "We're in."